From Soldier's Field in Chicago, where 110,000 people have filled this huge arena, the President of the United States gives his fourth address in his campaign for re-election. In addition to the throng inside the stadium, many thousands unable to get in will listen outside the gates. Mr. Roosevelt's train has just arrived from Philadelphia, crossing Ohio and Indiana, where he made platform appearances. The President's car has just come into Soldier's Field and all is in readiness. He will be introduced by Mr. Frank J. Lewis, National Chairman of the 1,000 Club, whose voice you will next hear. Mr. Lewis.
Well, fellow Americans, the President of the United States.
Mr. Mayor, Senator Lucas, and I think I'm not too previous in saying, Governor Courtney, my friends of Illinois and Indiana and Wisconsin, the American people are now engaged in the greatest war of all history. And we are also engaged in a political campaign. We are fighting this war, and we are holding this election, both for the same essential reason, because we have faith in democracy. And there is no force, and there is no combination of forces powerful enough to shake that faith. As you know, I have had some experience in war, and I have also had a certain amount of previous experience in political campaigning. But I must confess to you that this is the strangest campaign I have ever seen. I have listened to various Republican orators who are urging the people to throw the present administration out and put them in. And what do they say? Well, they say in effect just this. They say those incompetent blunderers and bunglers in Washington have passed a lot of excellent laws about Social Security and labor and farm relief and soil conservation and many others. And we promise that if elected, we will not change any of them. And they go on to say, those same quarrelsome, tired old men, they have built the greatest military machine the world has ever known, which is fighting its way to victory. And they say, if you elect us, we promise not to change any of that, either. Therefore, say these Republican orators, it is time for a change. They also say, in effect, those inefficient and worn-out crackpots have really begun to lay the foundations of a lasting world peace. If you elect us, we will not change any of that either. But, they whisper, we'll do it in such a way that we won't lose the support even of Gerald Nye or Gerald Smith. And and this is very important, we won't lose the support of any isolationist campaign contributor. Why, we will be able to satisfy even the Chicago Tribune. Tonight, I want to talk simply to you about the future of America. About this land of ours. This land of unlimited opportunity. I shall give the Republican campaign orator some more opportunities to say, me too. Today, everything we do is devoted to the most important job before us. Winning the war and bringing our men and women home as quickly as possible. We have astonished the whole world and confounded our enemies with our stupendous war production. With the overwhelming courage and skill of our fighting men, with the bridge of ships carrying our munitions and men through the seven seas, with our gigantic fleet, which has pounded the enemy all over the Pacific and has just driven through for another touchdown. Yes, the American people are prepared to meet the problems of peace in the same bold way that they have met the problems of war. For the American people are resolved that when our men and women return home from this war, they shall come back to the best possible place on the face of the earth. They shall come back to a place where all persons, regardless of race and color or creed or place of birth, where they can live in peace and honor and human dignity, free to speak, free to pray as they wish, free from want and free from fear. Last January, in my message to the Congress on the State of the Union, I outlined an economic bill of rights on which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all. And I repeat it now. The right of a useful and remunerative job in industry, in the shops, or the farms, or the mines of the nation. The right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. The right of every farmer to raise and sell his products for a return which will give him and his family a decent living. The right of every businessman, large and small, trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition, from domination by monopolies at home or abroad. The right of every family to a decent home. The right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. The right to adequate protection from the economic fear of old age, of accident, of unemployment. And, last of all, the right to a good education. Now, what do those rights mean? They spell security. And after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being. Some people, I need not name them, some people have sneered at these ideals, as well as at the ideals of the Atlantic Charter, the ideals of the four freedoms. They have said that they were dreams of starry-eyed New Dealers, that it is silly to talk of them, because we cannot attain these ideals tomorrow or the next day. But I think the American people have greater faith than that. I know that they agree with these objectives, that they demand them, that they are determined to get them, and that they are going to get them. The American people have a good habit, the habit of going right ahead and accomplishing the impossible. We know that. And other people know it. For example, today, there are those that know it best of all, the Nazis and the Japs. Now, this economic Bill of Rights is a recognition of the simple fact that in America, the future of the worker, the future of the farmer, lies in the well-being of private enterprise. That the future of private enterprise lies in the well-being of the worker and the farmer. It goes both ways. And the well-being of the nation as a whole is synonymous with the well-being of each and every one of its citizens. Now, I have the possibly old-fashioned theory that when you have problems to solve, when you have objectives to achieve, you cannot get very far by just talking about them. We've got to go out. We've got to go out and do something to assure the full realization of the right to a useful and remunerative employment. An adequate program must, and if I have anything to do about it, will, provide America with close to 60 million reproductive jobs. I foresee an expansion of our peacetime productive capacity that will require new facilities, new plants, new equipment capable of hiring millions of men. I propose that the government do its part in helping private enterprise to finance expansion of our private industrial plant through normal investment channels. For example, business, large and small, must be encouraged by the government to expand its plants, to replace their obsolete and worn-out equipment with new equipment. And just as an aside, but pretty important, the rate of depreciation on these new plants and facilities for tax purposes should be accelerated. That means more jobs. Jobs for the worker. Increased profits for the businessman. And a lower cost to the consumer. In 1933, when my administration took office, vast numbers of our industrial workers were unemployed. Our plants and our businesses were idle. Our monetary and banking system was in ruin, as we know. Our economic resources were running to waste. But by 1940, before Pearl Harbor, we had increased our employment by 10 million workers. We had converted a corporate loss of $5.5 billion in 1932 to a corporate profit after taxes of nearly $5 billion in the black in 1940. Obviously, to increase jobs after this war, we shall have to demand. We'll have to take care of an increased demand for our industrial and agricultural production, not only here at home, but abroad also. And I'm sure that every man and woman in this vast gathering here tonight will agree with me in my conviction that never again must we in the United States attempt to isolate ourselves from the rest of humanity. Yes, I'm convinced that with congressional approval, the foreign trade of the United States can be troubled after the war, providing millions of more jobs. Such cooperative measures provide the soundest economic foundation for a lasting peace, and that's what we want. And after this war, we do not intend to settle for anything less than a lasting peace. When we think of the America of tomorrow, we think of many things. One of them is the American home. In our cities, in our villages, on our farms. Millions of our people have never had homes worthy of American standards. Well-built homes with electricity and plumbing, air and sunlight. The demand for homes and our capacity to build them call for a program of well over 1 million homes a year for at least 10 years. Private industry can build and finance the vast majority of these homes. Government can and will assist and encourage private industry to do this, as it has for many years. For those very low income groups that cannot possibly afford decent homes at this time, the federal government should and will continue to assist local housing authorities in meeting that need. In the future America that we're talking about, we think of new highways, new parkways. We think of thousands of new airports to service the new commercial and private air travel, which is bound to come after the war. We think of new planes, large and small, new cheap automobiles with low maintenance and operating costs. We think of new hospitals and new health clinics. We think of a new merchant marine for our expanded world trade.